Hello, I'm Anna Serene and you're listening to Berlinale's House of Talents.
What if we were building this delicate machine that could make us work on our imagination regarding building our own memories?
At Berlinale Talents, we like to take the time to understand the how and why of filmmaking. This episode is a case in point. Céline Sciamma is a force of nature and one of French cinema's most prominent voices. She's the writer and director of, among others, Water Lilies and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which won her wide international acclaim and a Best Screenplay Award in Cannes. In 2021, Céline brought her fifth feature, Petite Maman, to the Berlinale competition. And we seized the opportunity to sit her down and ask her about the way she makes her films. Céline's films nearly always portray characters caught up in new desires, bridging childhood and adulthood as they make their way through the world. Drawing on Anglo-Saxon and French filmmaking traditions, Céline has created her own emotional language and elegant narratives. Her success testifies to the skill with which she makes her own imagination part of ours. During our conversation, I had the chance to ask Céline about her artistic coming of age, before we turn to what I suggested to her are her delicate machines. That is to say, her films. Céline, your films are very particular in their construction. They're sort of, as far as I see them, delicate machines where narratives move on these female protagonists that are always present in your filmmaking, whether they be girls or women or even older women, they span the generations and always introduce us into their worlds through, you know, looking, the gaze, desire. But to start with the beginning of your filmmaking career and perhaps the first three features, they're all in a, so just to cite them, Naissance des Pieuvres, Water Lilies, Tomboy, and Bande de Filles, which are all in a very specific cinematic genre, the coming of age movie. Why do you think you felt so attracted to that genre in particular?
Well, I've been answering that question a lot, and I'm always trying to answer it differently. Mostly also because, you know, it's a path from film to film. And of course, even though these three first films were built in the end as a trilogy, but I hadn't each film in mind while I was doing each film. But I decided to name it a trilogy because I wanted to depart from it in a way. So it's looking back, but trying to answer profoundly from today. Well, I've always considered that it was a genre, it's a true genre, but I don't know if it's really all told really well as a genre, especially from the French perspective and US perspective, or where teenagers in French movies and US movie and teen movies are not at all portrayed the same way. It's not the same rules, it's not the same culture. And back when I was doing Water Lilies and on those three first films, I must say, I was always trying to merge two kind of tradition. The French one, which is considering that looking at adults or children or kid isn't about only addressing yourself to kids or teenagers, but it's a cinematic genre. It's putting big characters on screen. And the teen movie, much more regarding the U.S. tradition, which is much more of a bubble. There are no grown-ups, whereas, you know, in France, since Les 400 coups by François Truffaut, it's also about a kid, like, struggling with the world of adults and trying to escape that world or fit in. So I always thought, oh, I'm kind of doing this fusion. And I used to tell it that way, so yeah, I could easily answer like that, like a robot.
I'll take that answer. I'll take that answer, and I think it's a wonderful way to begin, because I think that is what makes your position in French cinema so interesting, is that you have this Anglo-Saxon tradition that's really present, and in terms of, and it's, you know, aesthetically present, but it's also present in terms of the gender politics, and we'll get to that. But I think as a starting point to say that there's a tension between these two traditions is not wrong. And what I think would be fascinating to find out is how, you know, and so we have this genre of coming of age, but I'd be curious to hear about your artistic coming of age. So, you know, what type of films do you remember as a child thinking, oh God, that moved me beyond anything else I've seen? Or what books, because obviously you started your career as a screenwriter and screenwriting is at the center of your filmmaking as well. What books just moved you beyond, you know, to tears in your little bedroom, like your characters?
Well, it all started with comic books, I must say. And the strong, I mean, the Belgium and French tradition of bande dessinée. So it's either Tintin or Asterix or, this tradition of the comic book, which is called ligne claire, clear line, which is a term that I really like to use talking to my collaborators, always trying to find the clear line. And it's, ligne claire is really linked to this Belgium and French tradition of comic books. It's really linked to Hergé. Sometimes when I have trouble finding an idea for editing, like for instance in the first scene of Portrait, when the she's in the boat and then the canvas fell into the ocean, I was like, oh, how this is such an action scene. How am I going to do this? You know, in the language of the film. Plus, it's the first scene, so it shouldn't be like, because there's a stunt woman and everything. So then you're less free. How do we portray this? And, you know, and I'm always thinking, okay, look, what would, you know, Tintin, how would it be, you know? how something falls in the water? How do you edit that? So that was my first culture. I learned to read, reading comic books. And it's also, we can say, a fusion between, you know, literature and image and already some kind of storyboarding.
Yeah,
and addressing a perspective that is already both addressing adults and kids, which is also a kind of fusion that emerged that I'm always trying to do, whereas it's official or secret. This time it's official. And then I was also curated a lot as a kid by my father, who was a sci-fi geek.
So you grew up watching Star Trek and Star Wars and other such cultural
films? Regarding the film, but I think that was a cultural bath that we were all in. But regarding literature, reading sci-fi when you're an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, starting your career as a reader in novels with Ray Bradbury, or it's a strong baptism, science fiction. And then as a teenager, my only revolt, my only rebellion against that curation was to actually embrace a French classic of literature, Flaubert, Balzac, Zola, and be more study this literature with passion.
Study, and what do you mean by study? Because obviously the three authors that you've cited are 19th century authors that are working in a particular style, naturalism, a lot of irony, obviously Flaubert, a lot of attention to detail. So is that really what is happening in your mind? You're looking at the world differently after reading these authors. You're looking perhaps with a double edge, maybe even on people around you, in your family, on society. I mean, any reader of Flaubert is immediately a critic of society. So I'm wondering, from an early age, is that already in conjunction with Tintin, something that's happening?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know if as a kid or as a teenager, I felt like literature was helping me to look at the world differently. I just think it helped me to figure out the world, really. It was an education. It's also a cultural education that also was to be deconstructed. So that's why I'm very happy that I was given the opportunity to be an early reader, especially of the novel of the 19th century that I think are still feeding my work, really, I think we're nourishing for some parts of Portrait of Lady on Fire. And that we can say that page 28 is a cinematic idea, but it's also very much an idea of a novel of the 19th century. Yeah. And we could say that Petite Maman has a lot of links with Henry James, for instance, also, which was which is a recent read in my life.
Which one in particular, can I ask?
Well, all of them, but I mean, I really like the, I don't know what's the title in English, but it's the Motif dans la Tapisserie, which is
The Figure in the Carpet.
Figure in the Carpet. And it was, a curation given to me by my Italian, very dearest Italian distributor, Jerry Razzini. He's a legend. And he told me, I was talking to him about writing Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And he was telling me, you should read Henry James. And I did, and I think he gave me... it gave me a lot to think. It wasn't about reading literature and then seeing the world differently. It was actually reading literature and understanding the world as it went, actually, and seeing understanding the world better. Also, because from my perspective, being a gay kid. And knowing very early that I had other feelings, other perspective, other points of view around everything in life. I was lacking literature that would help me fit in the world. I was really feeding on literature that would give me the keys of the world, even though I'm not fitting in.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, literature does help us interpret the world and figure it out, but perhaps more predominantly it helps us figure ourselves out. And obviously, as a young gay kid, you're trying to understand perhaps what's gone wrong or why you're different or, you know, why you don't quite fit in. And mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, in these readings, were there particular characters? Because everything that you've cited, these are all male authors, but were there particular characters that emerge from this tapestry of literature that, you know, you thought, there's something here that I've put my finger on, as a queer reader always does, you know, you're always double guessing, double reading. Mm-hmm. And here, there's this sort of bubble and I can feel it and I'm interested in that because that's also what your films explore, that ambiguity.
Yes, of course. I mean, queer readers are great readers because sometimes it's just because they share a secret with an author or a book that is inside. Sometimes it's just because they're great at reinventing fiction and how it feels. Because it's not about what's hidden in a fiction, it's about how you feel about it. So it's not about, is that character lesbian or is that... a romance, that friendship is a love story. It's not about finding out. It's not about the clues. I mean, the clues are great. It's great to read a book and find out the clues. But it's also mostly about how you appropriate things. It's two different pleasures. It's the pleasure of, finding out the secret and sharing the secret. And it's also about, like, this makes me feel... I don't know. this is mine somehow, and because I'm gonna play with it, and I just wanted to tell you that I never really identify with character, and I'm not a character driven person. I know that it's always kind of disappointing when I do Q&As because everyone is always asking me about how are the characters. I'm like, they don't exist. So mostly the secret that I found in book is literature. And the fire that I found in book is literature. It's not about that character or that plot. And the fire that I found in cinema is cinema, is the fact that cinema exists. And the things that are the books that I love the most, it's the books that are celebrating literature. And the films that I like the most are the films that are celebrating cinema. And that can be either Wall-E or Jean Dillman. But they are celebrating cinema. And that's always what I'm looking for as an audience and what I'm looking for as an artist is that when you get out of the room, like when you close a book, you're not in love with that book or that character, or you don't connect or identify. I think that's very poor. you just love literature or you just love cinema. And that's what I was looking for as a reader and as a viewer. I was looking for that feeling of falling in love with art, really, more than characters or authors or, you know.
But the books
I've been a fan, because that's if you ask about how I was as a kid, I was a fan, really.
But you were a fan of, I mean, in what you say, what I understand is that it's not so much about the emotional implication with character, but the films or books that produce what you describe are doing that because they're pushing the boundaries of style within a given medium. And I think
Yes, and I mean, I think it's always an opportunity when you don't fit in. As a queer reader or as a queer viewer, I can't really connect with the characters. They're not designed for me to connect with them. So we have to connect with something higher, either our own imagination facing the opera, or just the fact that, just to fall in love with somebody's brain also, you know? Yeah.
So we've covered, you know, I'm looking at your bookshelf, I'm looking at this young Céline Sciamma's bedroom, right? So on the bookshelf, I see Tintin, I see Henry James, I see Flaubert. And then on the TV playing in this, you know, 1970s, 1980s living room, what are you seeing?
Denver, the Last Dinosaur. Nobody knows that. I'm a
dinosaur. Tell us about Denver.
I'm seeing, I'm a kid of TV. I'm a kid of VCR. So I'm a kid who records late TV to see films. So at first it's just basically what is on, and what is on is, and also I'm an elder sister. I have two siblings. So it's watching TV together. And also, I had a very long childhood because I had brothers and sisters. And so I kept watching, you know, what we were often as kids. And, you know, in France in the 80s, it was the rise of anime in French TV. So all those Japanese anime, even if some of them were designed by French people, actually, well, it was a very strong rise. And we'd watch that. And I think it created a whole real generation of otakus. So we were really plugged on that culture. TV culture, and also I began to record TV, late at night, so much more cine club side, to see some oldie movie, and I was also going as a geek to the cine club in my high school, so that's when I got to meet, when I started doing my own curation.
I didn't know this at all. So you started curating a film club. Is that right?
I was too shy to curate anything. I just went to the club and sat and shut my mouth and watched like Citizen Kane and, you know, The Third Man and, you know, all these things. This very classic cinephile culture. And also I was lucky to have a cinephile, and still have a cinephile grandmother, who handed me all the American comedy and also a lot of musicals. So it's all about
Billy Wilder, Ginger Rogers,
exactly, and all the James Stewart movies and Cary Grant movie, because she was an actor lover. She is an actor lover, and also all the musicals. So I had a very, very strong culture around musicals, Fred Astaire mostly. Fred Astaire team.
Can you tap dance?
I can, because I do. I mean, I everybody can. I really can do it very badly. Yeah, but I've tried a lot. Obviously, I've tried a lot for a very long time.
You'll show us another time if not tonight.
we'll see.
So fantastic. So we have this. There are lots of images, obviously, in what you're saying, and I'm very curious about your experience in the cine club. In that you said just now you were quiet and you were listening, and I think that doesn't surprise me at all, because your characters are always engaged in quiet looking observation at a remove before they ever, you know, put their feet in you know, their toes into the water. I'm thinking about water lilies here and the main character. They're always in they're always animated by the need to assess a situation before they plunge into it. And I think that's rather fascinating. But that doesn't mean they're not thinking, right? So I just wonder what you were thinking in that film club in terms of the films that you were seeing, and in terms of perhaps at that early age, the gender politics of these films.
Well, I was, I found it all very authoritative and fascinating because it was authoritative in a way. You know, that's what you're looking for when you're going to
the canon. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to, you know. It was mostly about, you know, for me, it was mostly about being serious about cinema.
Yeah.
Take it very seriously.
Yeah.
So I would go to the cine club, and also I would spend a lot, all my weekends at the, so this is a Faux Amis. So it's library.
Yeah.
Library is bibliothèque, right?
Yes.
Okay. I would go to the library, and when I would go like, okay, I'm going to study a contemporary Chinese cinema and the history of Chinese cinema as a 14-year-old, you know, and just go there, just read and study and trying to understand, okay, the big six, okay, Chen Kaiye, okay, the politics of cinema also, you know. When I'm passionate about something, I take it very, very seriously. And I think that's what my character do.
Yes.
Of course, they might be overthinking, but it's supposed to thinking, they're taking things very, very seriously. And that's maybe what's beautiful about the coming of age genre.
Yeah.
It's the deepness of the perspective, the depth of the perspective.
Yeah.
And it's the same with kids' perspective. I'm being asked a lot these days, like, oh, what's the kids' perspective? No, it's not the hate of the camera.
Yeah.
It's not about looking the world from death perspective, which is like a meter and 20 centimeter. I don't know how to say it in inches. You'll do the math. Yeah. It's mostly about the fact that their perspective is the fact that they are always in collective. They are always dependent and they are always connected to what's happening. You know, they're looking at their parents wanting to know them very badly because they've had a whole life before them. And they're, so their perspective is being very active, very caring, and taking things very seriously. That's a child's perspective. So it's not about it being cute or having this charm or having this poetic look on the world. It's about taking things very seriously. And I think that's why I've always, you know, tried to work around those characters. It's not because of their age or with their candor or their, it's about because it's because of their depth of the I hope I'm saying this right.
You are.
Profondeur of their perspective.
The depth of their perspective.
Maybe that's Kip Gates. Maybe that's Kip Gates. It's that, yeah, you take things very, very at heart. And that's why I'm very, you know, that's why, of course, this is a trilogy, and now I'm going back to kids' perspective, but it's just like trying to have always the deepest perspective. So maybe on family, you should look at a kid because they will give you the deepest perspective on that, you know.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so we have this notion of perspective, which is obviously central to your plots, and we'll get to that in a second. But just to finish on this arc of, you know, your artistic coming of age, in terms of seriousness and craft,
mm-hmm.
in French, I've invariably heard you say, le cinéma est un métier.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, filmmaking is a profession.
Mm-hmm.
And what made you want to make it your profession? Was it, you know, clear from the get-go that you were working towards that, or was there doubt in between? Was there even a false start into something else?
I think I'm saying it's a profession because I think it should be taken very seriously, but also because I had to make a living out of it, doing it. I see it as a profession also because I couldn't picture myself doing it if not as a job. And I don't know what's within that sentence once I said it.
Yeah.
But I said it.
I'm sort of trying to interpret it on the spot now.
Let's all take a moment.
But I mean, that notion of saying, okay, I'm going to work in film and I'm going to make it in film somehow, I'll make my way. That leads you to screenwriting.
Yeah.
That leads you to that literary aspect of film, which was also, you know, as a screenwriter, you're creating an object, your final object is destined to be thrown in the dustbin, right? It's that text that's supposed to disappear. And it's painful to see that happen and to see other people's, you know, hands on that, on those ideas. Is that perhaps what led you to direct? Or, you know, how did you jump from screenwriting to directing? Did it happen out of desire to direct, or as a matter of fact choice of saying, no, I have to see this idea, you know, professionally to the end, and therefore I have to direct?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, because I feel I mean, from a school perspective, I entered the National Film School as a screenwriter, and it's a very strict school. When you enter as something, even though you're going to go through discovering the whole process of cinema, you should say where you entered. And, you know, I'm very, I could at the time. But I directed my first film a year after I got out of film school. So my job was a director. I became a director right away. And so to me, screenwriting has never been, I don't connect, and I know it's true. I'm not saying I was privileged enough to never feel frustrated working for a script that was going to be directed for somebody else. And that's not because I'm a director, so I have my moment where I can do my stuff. It's because, as you said, screenwriting is about writing something that will disappear. So it's not about that, what you're going to write. It's about meeting people. And that's about meeting people. And I was lucky enough to work with people that I loved working with.
And there was an inherent joy for you in the writing process, right? Because any screenwriter knows that writing is rewriting, and you're living with a text that, you know, has multiple lives. Mm-hmm. And that for you retains its joy. That retains, I mean, it is always for you the center of the filmmaking experience, the beginning and its core, or has that shifted?
I mean, I think now I know about joy every step of the way. I wouldn't have said that if you asked me a few years ago. Mm. I've always been writing. It's the French tradition where we work with somebody. Yeah. So it's not about, but it could take different shape, because I like to work alone a lot. So I tend to work alone and then come back with something, and then we talk about it. And that's how I've been working. But it means hours and hours at the table trying to understand somebody. And, you know, for me, being a screenwriter, being a director and a screenwriter, I think when I'm hired by another director, he knows that I'm a director. So it's part of the deal. And that deal is that I'm going to look at my partner in writing, because, you know, we're writing together. As a director, I'm going to look at him or her with ambition for him or her as a director. So it's not about, I have the craft of screenwriting and then you're going to direct this. It's about really asking the questions about mise-en-scène and the ambition of the film, and trying to, you know, to build a script and you have a fantasy about it's the director's fantasy about the film, and you have a fantasy about what you want from that director. For instance, for André Téchiné, I work with around in a film called Being 17, he was very accurate about several desires that he had. And I tried to fulfill all his desires he wanted that there would be battles, physical battle scenes, but also a very quiet nature that would be his childhood nature. You know, you're in charge of all that. And it's beautiful to be in charge of all that, I must say. And then you have that. You're being handed that, and you have to, and it's really playful to try to bring this all desire to all together. And it's really also really peaceful, because it's not about your desires. And also you have your own project for the director. And for instance, I had my own project for André Téchiné, and that was like, I want to look at him as a very young man. I want him to make a very young man film. And I'm not going to tell him. You know, because
secrets.
Secrets. But that's my secret with the film. And my secret with the film is that I care. I have a fantasy for him. That is, maybe it's not his fantasy. So that's why I don't do screenwriting anymore. Hey, because it takes so much time and so much empathy. That's what it's always. I haven't been doing that much, I must say. Yeah. Because this time it's just so deep. You know, one of my projects has been going on for years, because there's also that's the film that I released with like directors that you know. But there's also all the work you do, people.
The other end of the iceberg, yeah.
Exactly, and I've been working, for instance, for 10 years with Jean-Baptiste Delobier, Parawan, who is the man behind the music in my films, around the film. And, you know, he's been actually doing it. The film is it's a 10-year work. There's also things you work around and you have desire for people, and then sometimes it takes years. So I might be a screenwriter. I mean, in the future, but I haven't been writing for other people now for really, I don't know, 4 years. Yeah.
But at the time where you were still at film school, is this the point where you realize that the types of narratives that you want to tell are not, in terms of gender, what is being told? Because that isn't easy in the French landscape at all to deal with.
No.
And I wonder at what point you realize that it's going to be a hard slog. Was it in conversation with other students? Was it when you did the film that you realized this? When did that happen, that consciousness?
I think it keeps happening. I think I'm much more aware of that now than at the time. Also because, cinema is this very weird art where that is based on reproduction. It's the only art where an artist can be really proud of saying, this is like in this. Mm-hmm. Have you seen, a novelist going like, this scene is inspired from the scene from that book, from that guy 5 years ago. So cinema is a culture that is with cannibalism and reproduction. So if you love cinema, you love that. And that's where we are in trouble, right? So at first, you're very submissive with that because you love cinema. Cinema is about reproduction. Cinema is a place where you're proud.
Especially as a fan.
Sometimes you're proud of parodies. And that's the beauty of it, because even though it's the same lens, it's the same shot, it's the same, exactly the same, it doesn't work the same. Mm. So, and it takes a lot of time to stop fetishizing things that you give you that kick, because that kick had a lot of impact in your life, because that kick show you loved before you loved. Show you sex before you had sex. Show you drink coffee in a coffee in Paris before you had a coffee in Paris. So that all those things gave you desire for life.
And this is, I think,
your life. Maybe they didn't give you desire for your own life. Mm. You know? So I think from film to film, I'm really departing from repetition and fetishizing. And maybe creating my own fetishes.
Yeah,
and
that's for sure. And in the clips that we'll show in a second, I there's signature elements of Céline Sciamma, which is the best possible thing that could happen to a filmmaker. So we'll get to that in a second. But just in terms of reproduction and this need to not reproduce or to question reproduction, I think for me, now that we have a filmography to look back at together, we have these five films. What is invariably there as a constant, as far as I'm concerned, is that political commitment in terms of the gaze, woman's gaze, becomes an aesthetic style, right? So we arrive at this sort of, I'm being very academic here, and you'll have to forgive me, but you arrive at this sort of aesthetics of equality. And I think that is, to me, what makes a Céline Sciamma film stand out and bold, is that you are not so much interested in plots where characters are in vertical relations on top of each other, in conflict, pushing down. What you're actually interested in is this, right? This plane of existence. And so when we enter your movies, like your characters at a remove, it's sort of to understand where the vertical abyss is. And by the end of it, we make that, you know, you walk that line and you arrive at equality and horizontality. And to justify this thesis, I think it'd be wonderful if you could talk a bit more about your first film, which to me is a very important film as a filmmaker. I'm deeply moved by Water Lilies, which wouldn't translate very well into English if we did translate the French title, which is Naissance des Pieuvres, Birth of the Octopi. It doesn't really, you know, and maybe it takes you back to sci-fi. But anyways, Water Lilies was your first screenplay that you ended film school with, and your first film. What drove you to tell the story of these three female protagonists and synchronized swimming? You know, where did that come from?
Well, that's really a personal anecdote. I went to a synchronized swimming show in my town because my friend, my neighbor, I decided to practice synchronized swimming, which is a hobby that you don't encounter every day. But in my town, I grew up in a new town that was built at the beginning of the 70s, and there was a nice rink. So we had this hockey team, one of the best in France. There was a baseball team. So, you know, a new town brings a new culture. Why am I telling you about my town, except the fact that I'm fascinated by it?
Maybe the swimming pool?
Yeah, the synchronized swimming show. So there was also a synchronized swimming team. And my friend, even though she was 14 years old, decided to begin synchronized swimming. And so she was very brave. And I went to see a show. And so she was... It's just a scene in the film, you know. It's just the beginning of the film. It's pretty much... what have been true. And I saw then there was like the champions team. And they weren't actually ballying on Verdi. They were ballying on Cotton Eye Joe. And you're going to have that in your head and I'm going to sing it. And it's a piano, so it's too bad.
Go for it.
You don't see it. We'll show you that. But still, even though it was Cotton Eye Joe, I was troubled. I was troubled, and I felt I had like missed my life. Said like I was like, yeah, I should have. I'm too moved by this. I should have done synchronized swimming. So I spent like three days, thinking I should have done synchronized swimming. Like, why do I feel so lame? Why do I feel like I'm missing something in my life? And it's just that I was so impressed by these girls. I guess impressed because they were accomplished, impressed because they were a team, impressed because they were carnivalesque femininity. And
the makeup and the bodices.
Yeah. And I was struck by the fact that this is a good story idea. You know, this is a good, when you don't understand what's happening to you.
But then you take that troubled, that trouble, right? That you find in the swimming pool, and you make it into another sort of trouble, which is the one of desire. And this is where we go back to coming of age, and perhaps we could look at a first clip from the end of or near the end of Water Lilies, where that question of desire, dreams as well, surfaces again, and then we'll talk about that in a second.
Faut plus qu'on se sépare, Marie. Je fais des conneries quand je suis toute seule.
Je fais la fête de la piscine après, tu viens? Non.
Well, I think we have two elements of your style here. We have two girls in bed, mm-hmm. talking. Mm-hmm. We have the first kiss, or a mm-hmm. kiss. Mm-hmm. And we have dreamers and daydreamers. And they're not kindly treated in your world, at least in this film. It's such a tender moment, and is quite representative of the film itself. But why did you feel the need to have these two characters say what they say to each other in that setting?
I think this, you know, it's always really crazy for me to watch clips of water lilies. Because it's my most conscious gesture, and that it aged pretty well.
Superbly.
And I think it aged pretty well because it's, I mean, I see now, you know, when the film was released, the friend character was named Anne, even though she's never named in the film. She's talking about the fact that she slept with this boy, and she's saying she slept, but you know, it's, I think now we would look at that scene as a rape. And you know, when I thought about the film, I mean, you know, we are thinking about rape culture, we are thinking about all this, you know, we're all thinking about that. I mean, we're not all, but I mean, we're all in a way, you know. fighting on different sides.
We should all be, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, yeah, I was thinking about that, but how can we represent rape? How it has always been represented not as rape, and you know, all those kinds of questions. I was like, oh, but I did represent it, not naming it.
There's another scene in the film where the character played by Adèle Haenel is, you know, interrupted in her discourse with the main character we've seen in, played by Adeline Paquin, by her trainer, who says, isn't it time for a massage?
Yeah.
Right? And then the door closes and we don't know what happens there.
Yeah, and at the time I was like, oh, this is too much. It was such a crazy person with very, very dark ideas. Yeah. And, you know, it's Adèle Haenel who told me that herself the other day. She went to do a screening in high school of Water Lilies. That's what I wanted to tell you. There's a scene after the, and at the end of the film, after that scene, exactly the scene that you showed, when the boy goes to see Anne's character and says, I like you, and he actually goes to kiss her, and she spits in his mouth. And at the time, everybody was in the audience, in the room. I've been in a lot of rooms with that film. They were screaming, really screaming, going like, or laughing, or, and now, in that high school where Adèle went the other day, they were just clapping, there was just cheering, and that's why it aged well.
It's a good measure of change.
My most radical film, because I had all this, because I took very, very seriously what was at stake for these teenagers. So it wasn't that I was politically constructed, that I was aware of the power of images. I was just caring a lot about the three of them. Not one, not the gawky teenager discovering she's a lesbian, and the object of all her affection being this, you know, bad girl, whatever.
It's not an ugly duckling narrative. Yeah.
It's about the three of them. Yeah. And Florian's character was very troubling for people at the time, saying, like, what does she want? Like, she's the bad straight girl and everything. No, she's the good straight girl. She's just going by the book. And we've all read this book. And the fact that the film is showing that, but also commenting on that between the characters, and that the whole friendship is built around politics in a way. You know, it's built around desire, but it's also built on politics.
Absolutely.
And that's something that amazes me. That's you know, we're talking to young talents. Like, I didn't know at the time. So follow your guts. Just follow that intuition. Your intuitions are political. They are political. They are not your intuitions about what you should do as an image. They're not about your personal stories. They're not about the films you love. They're not about that. Don't lose time. Really. Your intuitions, I think our intuitions are political. And that's why we should follow them.
Let's follow them, and let's follow what you mentioned in terms of desire, because there's another scene from the same movie which we can look at and then comment afterwards, but I think it's important to look at now.
Quand on y pense, le plafond, c'est sûrement le dernier truc qu'il y aura plein de gens. Au moins 90% des gens qui meurent, tu crois pas? C'est sûr.
Intuitions are political, said Insema, but so are little gestures, right?
Yeah.
Desire, that's that same bed that, you know, we'll find later on in the film. And this very tender but very powerful moment of a caress between two girls.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's nothing more accurate than a caress. The choreography of a caress. You know, we always feel like storyboarding. You know, you have to storyboard violence a lot. But caress is about rhythm and accuracy. Being precise is beautiful. That those fingers touching, that was like something that was so carefully crafted.
Yeah.
The disappointment for me in that scene, I must tell you, is that, you know, for me, when she says, this thing about the scenings, I'm like, for me, she was serious. It was deep thought, you know? And the first time the film, I mean, was in Cannes, obviously, the screens, but it kept going. In every country, people were laughing at that scene. They were laughing at that scene. They were amused, but I was taking it so badly. It was like, why are they laughing at such a deep thought? Because it's true, and it's a thought about death. It's a very teenager thought, but I was very young.
It's a thought about death.
No, I know this has also changed. I know that, you know, it's less of a, we're less embarrassed by the fact that a teenage girl could say something that true, actually. And it's not a, but the film was built in a way that, yeah, it's comedy also becoming, because it's somebody trying to look good. So that's always comedy, right? And then there's the truth of the breathing and this choreography of the caress, which is also a matrix in my work. Yeah. Because I enjoy a lot doing that. I think I'm coming to terms with that from film to film.
How the body talks and what the body says. Yeah, not only the eyes, but the body. And I think I actually want to see the last clip that we have tonight, which is from Portrait, because that horizontality of desire, that political intuition, it's also obviously in this very peculiar film, very beautiful film, where you move away from contemporary France, which was the setting for the first three coming-of-age movies, and you plunge us into an unspecified 18th-century-esque France, but where these questions of desire and truth are reinvigorated with the same actress that you shot with so many years ago, Adèle Haenel. So maybe we'll look at that last clip and talk about it as well.
Pose ta ferme. Ne dors pas. Ne dors pas. Ne dors pas. Ne dors pas.
What is beautiful to you, Céline Sciamma, it seems to me, is when we understand each other. I think that's perhaps the best encapsulation of what your cinema produces in viewers is to bring us to that moment where the war ends, mm-hmm. right?
I'm a pacifist. I'm a strong pacifist. I'm all about bridges. So I'm glad you said that.
As someone, you know, I know that you're a fan of Kubrick, and, you know, so is any aspiring filmmaker, right? But there is a particular logic to Kubrick that plays on war, as the canon does, right? And I think your force, force tranquille presque, your force is that you show us that truth and understanding are inherently beautiful. That the realization of desire is as beautiful as its failures. And this is a constant in your cinema, like a law that governs your work. And I did promise viewers that we would talk about Petite Maman, which is, as I said at the beginning, a little gift that operates on another level, right? It's less perhaps a question of desire than a question of memory, which is where I chose the previous clip. Je me souviens, I remember. But here memory takes on a mechanic of its own, right? It initiates something in the viewer. Perhaps you'd want to tell us a bit more about what exactly brought you to create that little machine.
Well, you know, memory, our memories, they are part of our imaginations in a way. Some of my memories from childhood, for instance, are clearly things that I remember. And some of them are clearly expanded from the photos, from the memories, the official memories of my childhood. So some of them, I'm pretty sure I can see myself in the frame, and some of them I am the character. What if we were building this delicate machine that could make us work on our imagination regarding building our own memories that are as valid as this picture, in a way. That birthday picture where, you know, your uncle has this weird face and you, you know, and that's your 6 years old, you know. What if you put somebody else in the picture? What if next to you there's somebody who's dead that you want to have next to you at that moment? This power of a brain that we need so much right now because we're locked in, I mean, that forest, which is in Paris, which is fake. So we need those kind of impulse, those triggers for this beautiful machine that we are with our brain and our heart. And what if we would create a film that would give us the impulse, the tool, the sensation. You know, it's like doing your first hypnosis, an hypnosis session, you know, for instance. Then you can do it. Then you can, it changes the way you focus. It changes the way you live a room without living it. It's an experience. So Petite Maman might be my most ambitious experience regarding how collaborative the viewer is and regarding how much this time, which is always the project, the viewer is the hero of the film rather than the character being the hero of the film. Character is the hero of the plot. Once more, the characters don't exist. That's why you can write about them. That's why you can imagine everything, or as much as I can imagine what they're going through, what they went through, you know.
Could I just say, in terms of that ambition, maybe to specify its nature. To me, up until now, up until Petite Maman, we were in a naturalist, realist framework within a certain tradition of French filmmaking. I think it's not, you know, anything polemic to say. But here, when you say your ambition extends, it does in a very particular manner, in that we begin to dream, actually. So all the characters that we've seen, the female characters that we've seen in bed, thinking, talking, telling the truth, but never really dreaming. Mm-hmm. And with Petite Maman, it's really you're offering us a dream that becomes very personal. It's a very, very special film, especially now. I think you're absolutely right to say, I know that you started shooting in studio, you know, as lockdown was announced in Paris, etc. So it's a film that was in a bubble of its own, and that it's, that is, you know, more or less going to be consumed in that same bubble by the viewer, right? And in that, it does elicit questions about, without, you know, without disclosing the conceit of the film, it is a mother-daughter story, but of a very particular kind. And it does work like a sort of, you know, a delicate machine, but also a time bomb. It does open up flows into our memory. It asks us to delve into parts of our memory and parts of our, you know, relationships with our parents in particular. And that perhaps is something that, in terms of the metaphysical aspects in your filmmaking, wasn't the case. So where did that ambition come from? Why now? Why that?
Well, that ambition comes from that idea. I mean, I have ambition for ideas. I don't have ambition for myself. I have ambition for ideas that I have when I'm lucky to have ideas. And I was lucky enough to have that one. And so then it unfolded a whole new possibility of cinema, and that's why I'm most, what I'm always looking for.
And you've succeeded.
But every film, you know, it's funny because, you know, I'm being asked a lot of questions about shooting during lockdown and everything, and I keep saying, yeah, every film is a personal lockdown. But if you're having this lockdown within a lockdown, then it's not a lockdown. You're connected.
I know that we have to bring things to a close, but perhaps that's the best way to do it, in that, you know, everyone who's watching us is in lockdown, but thanks to you, I feel we are all kind of connected through a very particular film and your filmography. So I would like to thank you personally for the opportunity of talking with you, and I'd like to thank the audience for joining us, and wish you all a good evening. Thank you.
A very special conversation with an immensely passionate filmmaker. Be sure to catch Petite Maman when it comes out, and dive into Water Lilies if you haven't already. It's a stunning debut feature. If you want to hear from other directors, or indeed from a range of engaging filmmakers we've had the chance to talk to over the years, subscribe to our channel and visit our website at berlinale-talents.de. This podcast is brought to you in cooperation with Goethe Institute. It is produced by 4000 Hertz. Our editor is Vincent Forster. Music is by Rutger Reiners. Project coordination, Rabea Bockholt. Project management, Christine Trostrum and Florian Weghorn. And it was presented by me, Anna Serene. Thank you for listening.